His new album, Reverie, is a raw, raucous, and messy affair. Those are his words, not mine. It features Kiefer Cienza on piano, David Pilch on upright bass, Jay Bellarose on drums, Mark Ribot, on acoustic guitar, and Joe Henry playing acoustic guitar and singing. It was recorded in 3 days in Henry's basement studio with the windows open, and if you listen carefully, you can hear a dog barking on one of the tracks. Joe Henry is also a Grammy-winning producer who has worked with a diverse collection of recording artists, including Solomon Burke, Ramblin' Jack, Jack Elliott, Alan Toussaint, the Carolina Chocolate Drops, Over the Rhine, among many others. We're going to play some of those recordings and highlight songs from Joe Henry's new and most recent albums, and it's nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning, Joe Henry.
Good morning. Thanks for having
me. You're very welcome. This new album feels very live and unscripted. Was that the intention?
That was the intention. These things don't happen by accident anymore. It was live. We set up not only in the same room, but as close to each other as we physically could, that would still allow the engineer room to move. We just wanted the lines between instruments to blur, and I think that happens. And by the way, you don't have to listen closely to hear dog,
no.
And it's not just on one track. There are dogs all over this record.
And there's someone delivering the mail.
It happens.
But the idea was what? To take down that sort of hermetically sealed wall between the studio and the outside world?
Well, that's always true the way that I work, especially in my studio at home. But when I'm producing somebody else, I have a lot of anxiety about outside noise drifting in, because some artists, believe it or not, don't want a dog barking on their record. But I also started to notice that, you know, songs don't happen in a vacuum. You know, when I'm working on a song as a piece of writing at home, I'm keenly aware that it's happening and being revealed, you know, as everything else is happening around me. And there's no such thing as, you know, John Cage taught us there's no such thing as silence. So you can either fight it or you can embrace it. And at this point in my life, I'm delighted to embrace the noise and the chaos.
Is there a theme to Reverie? I mean, as you look back over the songs that you've written for this new album, do you see a theme?
I do, and I did have to look back to see it. You know, I don't impose anything like that on a group of songs, but I think that if there's a theme, I think all the characters in the songs are wrestling with an awareness of time passing. So I think time is sort of being imposed on all the images. All the pictures. But I think, as I think about it, I'm not sure there's any decent song ever written that doesn't have to confront time, you know. You might have to dig a little deeper in some than others, but every character, you know, if you follow the arc of a song, is you know, wrestling with their own desire.
Sure.
Against the time that they have to realize it.
I'm not sure how old you are, but do you feel the passage? You look like perhaps you're middle aged.
I turned 50.
Oh, there you go.
This past December, but I swear that had nothing to do with me writing about time.
Is that true?
No, no. I think it is true. I was delighted to turn 50. I'm liking it very much. I don't think that I had any secret angst that then started to surface in songs. I don't write about my life that way.
You write about characters, right?
Yeah, and I find out what they have to tell me. And I find out that some of them were very concerned about time.
Well, I do want to play a song from your new CD, Reverie, and this is a song called Room at Arles. I actually downloaded online Van Gogh's painting called Room at Arles. It's a very famous painting with a bed and very, very sort of architectural, interesting perspective. Were you thinking about that painting as you wrote this song?
Actually, when I wrote the song, I was thinking very much about my late friend, the great singer-songwriter Vic Chestnut, who took his life this last Christmas, I guess a year ago Christmas. Yeah. And I'm not trying to draw too straight a line, you know, to reference one troubled genius to another, but I did start thinking about the fact that Van Gogh painted his little room there, and we know a lot about him because of his absence in this space. And I started to think about Vic and how much that we still feel his resonance in his absence. You know, these songs you write are kind of rooms that you build and then walk out of. So, you know, I did have that in mind as I thought about Vic. And it's not a song about Vic, but it's certainly something written while he was very present in my mind.
Well, let's listen. This is Room at Arles.
The ground will rise to meet me right where my knees begin. The sun will slip between them now to button my undoing. The sun will slip between them now to button my undoing. Crows and then another crow beside me in a tree, like black shoes in a dusty row trailing after me. My hands are wet from walking, but I'm high enough to see the stars that wait below me where my hat is falling free. Out above the rooftops, the moon is holding sway. A narrow eye low in the sky, knowing what I'm knowing. I have left the table now, and this is just to say, every song I ever sung has been a song for going. Every song I've ever sung has been a song for going.
That's our guest, Joe Henry, singing Room at Arles from his forthcoming CD called Reverie. It's you and your guitar. I love, first of all, I love the lyrics. And
thank you.
I love the spareness of that song.
That's the first time I've ever recorded myself just alone on acoustic guitar. You know, my wife has wished forever that I would make a full record that way. And, you know. I guess that was just my way of saying that I'm probably never going to do such a thing. But I like the drama of that. You know, I like how that exists. I wouldn't want a whole record of that necessarily, at mm-hmm. least not yet. But it speaks a certain way when that happens. You know, everything clears out when there's been a lot of other ruckus going on.
I was watching you listening to yourself, and, mm-hmm. and I'm always curious, mm-hmm. you know, when an artist is listening to their composition, what's going through their head? Are you saying, damn, I'm good?
Well, I have thought that. I wasn't thinking that exact moment, probably. I was enjoying the ambient sound, you know. That particular guitar I was playing was a gift that showed up 30 minutes before that song was recorded, and it was unexpected. Some friend of mine who runs a guitar shop in Canada sent me this old 1938 Washburn archtop that was very beat
gosh.
Up, and I went up and answered the door. There was the FedEx man. He hands me this box. I unwrapped it, tuned up this guitar, and then thought, oh, I guess I should play this. And it's perfectly honky and buzzing in all the right places, as I hoped it would be. And
boy, how so serendipitous is that, right?
So there was a lot of that week, you know. I got lucky.
I want to play another song, and this is actually from a previous album of yours, Blood from Stars, a song called The Man I Keep Hid. And as you have said, you write as a character. You don't necessarily write as you know, The Man I Keep Hid as a song about yourself.
No.
Well, let's listen.
Something startled you late last night. Something startled you late last night. A ghost from my dreams, leaning pain, moved in you, left a paper trail. Nobody knows the man I keep you.
That's a song called The Man I Keep Hid from Joe Henry's 2009 album Blood from Stars. So when you're writing, do you have to sort of get in character the way an actor might get in character? Do you think of it that way?
I suppose I do, but I don't have to do it. I don't have to work at it. You know, when a song is there to be written, it's sort of like the character is just, you know, there to be embodied. I don't have to be like Dustin Hoffman, you know. I don't have to go on any regime, you know. I don't have to hire a trainer. I just sort of, you know, I just try to be open to it.
Which is how novelists often talk about writing a novel and how characters appear to them.
Well, some of them, I'm sure. You know, I know that there are writers who outline everything and work that way, but I was trained from a different school. You know, I think of Flannery O'Connor, for instance, who's a very heavy number for me. Mm-hmm. And I remember her saying that, she was talking about this great story called Good Country People, where a traveling Bible salesman seduces a young farm girl who's got a wooden leg, and he gets her up in the hayloft and convinces her to take her leg off, and then he steals the leg and runs away. And she said, I had no idea he was going to steal her leg until a sentence before, but I was delighted. And again, it goes back to the idea that you're writing to find out what you're writing about. You know, for me, writing has almost nothing to do with self-expression, in quotes. It's all about discovery. I don't think I would write a song if it was based on, I have this idea, and now I need to, you know, put it in three verses that rhyme so other people can enjoy it too. I write to find out. And if it serves me, then I sing it.
We're almost about a break here, but do you begin with a musical line? Do you begin with the words when you're writing a song?
Oh, it happens every which way, you know. I'm very word-oriented as a songwriter and as a listener, at least initially. I always was. So frequently it's an image, it's a title, it's a line. You know, sometimes just a phrase will speak itself in your mind and you think, it's like seeing something shiny sticking out of the dirt, you know. If I dig in there, it might be nothing, it might be a whole bicycle down there, and I can ride away with it. But you don't know until you start digging.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Joe Henry. He has a new album coming out in October called Reverie. He's also a Grammy-winning producer. He's worked with a diverse collection of recording artists, and we are playing selections from some of his music, and we'll be also playing selections from some of these artists that he has recorded and worked with. And first of all, we're going to take a very short break, then we'll get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Rittenhouse Square Fine Arts Show supports WHYY and Circles the Square in Philadelphia's Rittenhouse Square at 18th and Walnut, Friday through Sunday, September 16th through the 18th. Open Friday, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., Saturday, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Sunday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., featuring original artwork from over 140 locally and nationally recognized artists. A variety of paintings, prints, drawings, and sculpture will be exhibited. The Rittenhouse Square Fine Arts Show. Details available at rittenhousesquareart.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Will Arnett. He co-starred in Arrested Development as Job, and on 30 Rock he played Jack's rival, Devin Banks. Now Arnett is starring in the new comedy series Up All Night, about a sleep-deprived couple adjusting to their new lives as parents. And we'll hear from two neuroscientists who've written a new book about how a child's brain develops. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Penn's College of Liberal and Professional Studies proudly supports WHYY and offers an interdisciplinary Master of Environmental Studies program for students who are passionate about clean air, clean water, and a clean earth. Academic work on local and global environmental issues combines with fieldwork in Philadelphia and around the world. More details on Penn's Master of Environmental Studies online by searching Penn MES.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Joe Henry, who has won 3 Grammys as a producer, and his 12th album, Reverie, is going to be released in October. I do want to play another song from a 2009 album called Blood from Stars, and this is a song called Death to the Storm. Let's listen.
There's a song we used to know, a kind of weary blues, some broken tune from long ago, some of us still like to use. It hangs up high in the rafters like smoke. It has no form. Keep it all hid like laughter and sing out death, death to the storm.
Death to the storm, death to the storm, death to the storm, death to the storm.
We keep it all hid like laughter and sing out death,
death to the storm.
And again, Death of the Storm from our guest, Joe Henry's 2009 album, Blood from Stars. You've been working with some of these same musicians for, what, a long time now?
Some of them for, you know, closing on a decade, yeah. I don't only work with them, but there are a few of them, you know, who are my very close friends and my deep confederates as musical collaborators that I work with as much as possible. You know, I like to think of myself as, you know, Fellini, and Jerry Bellarose as Marcello Mastroianni.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. There you go.
But it's also sort of a Motown template where you have a, you know, a consistent pool of musicians, and they can move around. They're not all always exactly the same configuration. But, you know, people who love the process and the way that we do it and are great at really putting a light on a song. You know, they're not trying to make a mark. They don't have a preconceived idea of what their sound is or what their role is. They're just in service to the song. And when you find people who can and will do that, it's really hard to let go of them.
Oh, indeed. And there's so much chemistry. I mean, there's history there, obviously, but I would think as well some degree of chemistry.
Well, it's immense, and it's probably amazing. It would be amazing to some people how little we talk about music when we're making it.
Oh, interesting.
Because it's just sort of understood when we're in a room together. We all know what we're after. Mm. You know, it's like a séance. You know, everybody knows when, you know, something's been conjured and when the room is cold. And when you have that sort of communication with people, you know, it's foolish to give it up just because somebody else thinks you should be dating more, you know.
Well, as you mentioned in this new album, Reverie, not only were the windows open and all of that, but you sat very close together. The idea that the sound would kind of bleed from one instrument to the other, you were so close you could feel it.
Well, I was as close to you know, Kivas at the piano as I am to you, as close to the drums as I am to you. You know, we were all literally on top of each other, you know, with the idea that, you know, part of what the drums sound like is how they're hitting the piano mics and spilling into the vocal mics, and things get very confused. And I work with a brilliant engineer named Ryan Freeland. I work with him exclusively because he knows how to take that picture. You know, you're standing in a room. If you were standing in the midst of us when we were playing, you know, there's each instrument, but there's all this overtone and stuff that's very available in the air if you're standing there. But you really have to know, you know, your engineer is your translator. And I always think it's just like if you have, you know, Garcia Marquez sitting here with us and he was, you know, going on. If there's not somebody there to take it down and translate it out into the world, you know, apart from you and I, it didn't happen.
Exactly.
And he's as important as any musician in the room. And this idea would never have worked if he didn't know how to take that picture in a musical way. When I say I want all that grain, all that noise in the air, you know, he knows how to do that.
What's in your recording studio? What does it look like?
Well, it's
and
the,
what are all the
it's the basement of a very historic home. I live in South Pasadena. Doesn't mean I want anybody to come there, by the way. It was a home built for the widow of President Garfield after he was assassinated. It's called the Garfield House. And when it was built in 1904, there was a big kitchen and a cook's quarters in the basement. And in 1916, they moved that up to the main floor and added onto the house. Thus, there's this big, beautiful space down there that opens into the backyard. It's not a bunker, you know. There's lights. I mean, there's windows and doors and there's this big stone wall. There's a brick wall. There's, you know, all kind of things going on down there.
A lot of equipment down there too, or do you keep that spare as well?
No. There's a lot of old gear. You know, we record to the computer like most people, but we use a lot of really really old microphones and tube preamplifiers and compressors, you know. Mm-hmm. The computer will take a beautiful picture of whatever you give it. It won't enhance it like tape used to enhance sound. So if those are things that you like, those mm-hmm. qualities that tape used to offer, you just have to, you know, front load that before you get to the computer, and you know, Ryan knows how.
Well, and I love that tube sound. I mean, it has a kind of round sound when you hear music through tubes.
Well, it sounds like a lit bulb, you know. If you look into the back of a tube amplifier and you see those tubes glowing back there, that's exactly what it sounds like. Yeah. I find that most recording gear, sounds exactly like it looks.
Well,
you know, I can
pick
a microphone out of a chest and know what it'll sound like by what it looks like.
You have worked with a lot of recording artists. Are there certain people that you look for, or that you have sort of hunted down? Are there ones that approach you? I'm assuming it's probably a mix of things.
It is a mix.
At this point,
some of my most rewarding work has come from me stalking people, and I mean hunting them down and maybe suggesting they make a record even if they weren't thinking about making a record. And sometimes you just get a call out of the blue, you know, right. And it's startling when that happens. You know, one day, you know, you get a call that, and somebody says, would you like to work with Salif Keita in Paris? And you say,
sure.
Sure, I would. You know, it happened with Solomon Burke. You know, I got a call one day and somebody said, you know, would you like to produce Solomon Burke? And I thought it was sort of like a personality quiz, like, you know, would you sleep with Rita Hayworth if you were sure your wife would never know? Just to see what you know, where you come down on such things. I didn't know that Solomon Burke was around to be worked with. You know, I mean, I admired him like everybody, but I didn't know he was still making records. Mm-hmm. So when somebody called and said, "Hey, would you want to produce Solomon Burke?" You know, you think, well, that would have to be interesting. At least would have to, you know, get in the ring. You know, who knows who's going to crawl out of it, but I'm game.
But it must be such an interesting relationship. I mean, with each of these musicians, it has to be uniquely different.
Well, it is, and it's intense. It's like being in the army together. You know, you have these intense, because I make records, almost all the recording happens, you know, within like 3 to 5 days. So you go in for these incredibly intense, you know, adventures, and you sort of form really in close ties with people because you've been through something together, and it stands, you know.
Well, you know, I'd love to play from an Alan Toussaint album, The Bright Mississippi, a song called "Just a Closer Walk with Thee," which, of course, is a very well-known song. And I just have to say, I just love this recording.
Thank you. That was a really special record for me, and I don't throw that word around like the young people do.
Well, let's listen. As I said, beautiful. Just a Closer Walk with Thee from Alan Toussaint's album, The Bright Mississippi. That was Don Byron who we were listening to as well. And it's just, I feel like when I heard that for the first time, that I was hearing it for the first time. You know what I mean?
Well, that's how it's supposed to work, Marty. I mean, and you know, that was a first take. And and I don't believe in pre-production and the idea of like you rehearse something in a studio, in a rehearsal space, and then come into a studio just to read it into the public record, you know, to tape. I mean, I want to record that moment of discovery. And in this case of this record, even though Alan is such a genius as an arranger, I asked him, you know, don't write charts for anybody. I want everybody just to learn the songs as far as, you know, the melody, the shape of it. But, you know, I want people playing. I don't want people reading. And I'm going to put people in the room who know how to do that, who know, you know, how to listen to you as a player and go where you're going. And that's a great example of it. You know, just this song came up, and it's a popular funeral song in New Orleans. You know, but I think what you really hear is this great conversation between Alan and Don, and how much, you know, Don was just delighted to be playing with Alan, and Alan was having his first exposure to Don and was just completely just loved his playing from the first moment he started playing. I mean, Alan was just beaming, and that's just, you know, that's what you want to record.
Magic. Yeah,
you know.
And that's Joe Henry. He's a Grammy-winning producer. In fact, has won 3 Grammys as a producer. He also has a new album coming out in October. It's his 12th, and it's called Reverie. Someone that you really did have to track down was Mose Allison.
Yeah.
And I guess you've told this story many times, but it's a great story, and we do want to play My Brain eventually, but how did you finally convince him, I guess, to work with you?
Well, the short version of the story is I had invited him to a festival that I was curating in Germany, and that took some work, but there he came, and we were spending 5 days together, and the promoter in Germany was smart enough to invite Mo's wife to come with him. She's a retired high school English teacher, and she's not attached to the music business at all. And she and I hit it off, and we, you know, spent days talking about Walt Whitman and Alice Munro. And And she and I started corresponding through email, and I kept saying, like, I really want to make a record with Mo's. And she said, I think he's done recording, actually. He hasn't made a record in 12 years. Mm-hmm. You know, he still plays shows, but he's not recording anymore. But she liked the idea, you know, of us together. And so I sort of went on a letter writing campaign. Mose himself doesn't do email, but, you know, Audrey does. So I would write long letters to Mose and email Audrey, and she would print them out and leave them at the breakfast table for him. And I just sort of continued to pursue him, and we'd get on the phone once in a while, and he kept waving me off. And then finally one day he just said, so, like, what would I do? Like, I come to your house? And I said, yes, you would come to my house, and we would play music. And
he said, okay.
And, yeah, he just sort of acquiesced. And I don't know if he really decided he still had something to say as a recording artist, or he just wanted to, you know.
Put you through your paces?
Stop the flurry of mail. But, you know, we had 4 days together, and I've been listening to him since I was, you know, 15 or something like that. My wife has older brothers and uncles who were crazy Mose Allison fans, so she was hearing him her whole conscious life. And I remember her telling me that she was Mose was at the piano underneath the floor of the office my wife has at the house, and she was emailing her uncle and just saying, you know, I'm writing to you, and Mose Allison is playing and singing, coming up through the floor under my feet this moment, you know. And he was 83. It was no small thing that he showed up, you know, and it was really life affirming.
Well, let's listen. This is Mose Allison's album, The Way of the World, 2010. It came out, and a song called My Brain.
My brain is always ticking, my brain. My brain is always ticking, my brain. My brain is always ticking, long as I am live and kicking, my brain. Cool little cluster, that's my brain. My brain is steady working, my brain. My brain is steady working, my brain. My brain is always working, long as you keep that coffee perking, my brain. Cool little cluster, that's my brain.
A song called My Brain, Mose Allison from the album The Way of the World. I'm assuming when you're, I mean, you spend a lot of time wooing him and getting him to agree, but then once it comes together and it sounds like that, as a producer, that must feel great.
Oh, it does feel great. I mean, it's one thing to have the idea of something in the abstract, and then to actually be able to stand away from it and have it, you know, carry on without you. I mean, that's always the goal. I mean, I unlike some people, I love closure. You know, I love to have something done. And the whole, you know, gag of recording is to have something stand up like a living thing and announce itself and go on without you. Because I always think that, well, there's an idea. I don't have to babysit anymore. It has its life, and I'm free of that one. You know, it's just another big sofa you can move out of the room and make room for a new one.
So when something like that is being recorded, where are you? What are you doing? Do you have a clipboard in your hand? Are you just listening? Do you have headphones on? Are you pacing? What are you doing?
Mostly, I mean, I can picture myself with Mose. He was just the other side of a glass for me, and I was just sitting on the floor looking at him, sort of marveling at it. And you know, the biggest part of my job is to remind people that they're being heard. You know, you stand in as the first audience. You're, as my friend T-Bone Burnett says, you know, you're the proxy for whatever audience is ever going to exist for this music. I heard him actually on talking to Terry Gross, my friend and my professional godfather, T-Bone Burnett, the musician, songwriter, producer. And she asked him, you know, what does it mean to produce a record? Most people don't know. You know, what do you do as a record producer? And I feared that maybe she thought he was being, you know, flip about it. But I remember hearing him and being startled that he had just sort of generously given away the store. You know, what he said to her was, you know, you just listen really hard until it gets good. And that is, you know, except for, you know, making sure that the espresso machine is hot, you know, all the time, and getting the right people in the room, that's a big part of the job, is to keep listening until it gets good.
That's great. Let's take a short break and we'll get back to our conversation with Joe Henry. He is a Grammy-winning producer and he's got an album coming out in October called Reverie. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Widener University presents the Philadelphia Speakers Series in its 8th sold-out season at the Kimmel Center. 7 evenings with a fascinating, provocative, and delightful assemblage of life's adventurers. Storytellers who inspire us. Mavericks who challenge the status quo. They encourage new ideas and help us to understand the world in which we live. Information on how you can subscribe for future sessions at PhiladelphiaSpeakersSeries.org. Sponsored by WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. How does the Arab Spring and the Palestinian move to ask the UN for statehood change the equation for Israel in the Middle East? Also, a look at the fall TV season. Hint, if you want good drama, go to cable. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Opera Company of Philadelphia launches the 2011-12 season this month, featuring Bizet's Carmen, Mozart's Abduction from the Seraglio, and Puccini's Manon Lescaut at the Academy of Music, and more intimately scaled productions of Nico Muley's Dark Sisters and Curtis Opera Theater's Elegy for Young Lovers at the Perelman Theater. 215-732-8400 or operaphila.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with music producer and musician, guitarist and recording artist Joe Henry. Where were you born? You were born in
Charlotte, North Carolina.
Is that where you grew up?
No, I moved all over. My dad was an executive for Chevrolet, and if you're in the auto racket, or at least when you used to be in the auto racket, all roads lead to Detroit. So we sort of snaked our way to Michigan. You know, I lived in Charlotte and in Atlanta for a while, a couple stops in Ohio, and then sort of came of age in a suburb outside of Detroit.
Wow. And were you then the new kid in school every September?
Every third year, yeah.
Really?
It was wicked. I was very shy as a young person, and I found moving to be really, really difficult. But in hindsight, you know, that may be why I retreated into music the way that I did. You know, I just lived for songs, you know, from a very, very young age, before I even knew that I was, you know, what it meant to be obsessed with something. I was sort of obsessed with songs.
Does that mean your house, your parents played music all the time, or there was music on player?
My parents are not leisurely people. They're workers. As retired people, they're workers. They listen to a lot of music now. But, you know, when I was growing up, I think, you know, I feel like my parents owned like three records. You know, they had like a, you know, a Roberta Flack record and a Jim Nabors Christmas record and something else. You know, they never put music on. But my brother and I, my older brother Dave, you know, we brought music home constantly. And I will say that, you know, for all the racket that came out of our rooms, and even, and then by the time I was playing, you know, they never once told me to hold it down.
Good parents.
Very good.
And did you have a band? I mean, were you a kid with a band?
No, I was always a solo artist. I'm not democratic in my working life.
And were you writing songs as a young person?
I started trying to write songs at about 14, you know. It was a while before I had anything that was real, but I knew, I mean, I remember the one time I ever talked to a guidance counselor in high school, and she said, "What do you want to do when you get out of school?" And I said, "I'm going to be a songwriter." And she was taken aback. She said, "Do you write songs now?" And I said, "No, but I'm going to." I believed that what I was doing was teaching myself to write songs, you know. I was writing fragments, sort of in imitation of William Carlos Williams, you know, thinking that what I was approaching, ultimately, that it's like somebody trying to get a running head start. If I keep doing this, you know, one of these thoughts is going to present itself as musical, and I'll be able to imagine how it could be sung.
Sounds like you're a reader.
Yeah, I'm a reader. I read a lot of things. I mean, I've learned as much from certainly short story writers as from any other songwriter. You know, I think it's really limiting to talk about music only in terms of other music. People who ask me as a songwriter, what other songwriters influenced you? I can give you the list, but, you know.
Well, you talked about Flannery O'Connor,
you know,
right?
Eudora Welty, you know, Ray Carver, you know, Nathaniel West, J.D. Salinger, Alice Munro, absolutely. I think she's a genius. Garcia Marquez changed my life. I mean, I remember where I was. I remember reading 100 Years of Solitude when I was 20, and it changed my whole perception of what I thought good writing might be. I mean, I was just flabbergasted when I read it. You know, some poets, you know, Wallace Stevens, you know, Williams, Walt Whitman, you know, people like that, the usual suspects, you know, and then there's all the songwriters and all the filmmakers. I'm mad for film, and I, you know, I'll reference movies making records all the time, but I almost never reference other records when we're trying to make a record. It's sort of too on the nose. Mm-hmm. Doesn't offer a new point of view.
Would you like to do music for a movie?
Well, I've done music for film. I'd like to do more. My friend and one of my heroes, Loudon Wainwright III, scored the film Knocked Up together. I've written songs for films, you know, and I've scored a few other films. I mean, I love film, and I like what music does to it.
Yeah, and when it works so subconsciously, in a way.
Well, I mean, when it really works, you shouldn't be noticing it. Exactly. But I think the same as my job as a producer. You know, I don't want anybody to see my hand at work. If you're doing your job, you should just disappear into the song always. Like, I mean, I say that as a songwriter too.
It's like a good edit, right?
Yeah, you should never notice. You should just feel yourself sort of, you know, stand up a little bit when it happens.
Well, speaking of producing, I do want to go back to another album that you produced, the Carolina Chocolate Drops Grammy-winning album, Genuine Negro Jig. And we do want to play a song called Hit 'Em Up Style, which is actually a cover of a hip-hop song. Right. What was it like to work with them?
It was, you know, as it frequently is, it was great and it was intense. I mean, you know, they have a really intense dynamic as a trio. And I frequently work... not by choice, it's just how it's happened. I frequently work with solo artists, and I put a band around them. It's really different and exciting to work with a, a group that's already a group, because you're sort of inheriting somebody else's marriage and you're stepping in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. You know, I did it when I worked with Elvis Costello. You know, I mean, I realized that between Elvis and Steve Naive and Pete Thomas, you know, that's a 30-some-year marriage you're getting in the middle of. And at a certain point, you can sort of help negotiate that marriage. At a certain point, you just say, maybe I should step out of the room for a second. Not because anything heinous is happening. It's just that there's something that's happening that demands your respect. I mean, I can have a point of view, but I don't pretend that I share that history. Same with anybody.
Yeah.
And for the Chocolate Drops, it was the same way. I offered what I could, and I also tried to respect that there was a relationship in progress. And you know, you want to facilitate, you want to encourage, and you want to let that relationship flourish.
Let's listen. Hit 'em up style.
Your hands on his cash and spend it to the last dime for all the hard times. When you go, then everything goes from the crib to the ride in the clothes. So you better let him know that if he messes up, you gotta hit him up.
And we're talking with Joe Henry, and that's an album he produced, the 2010 Carolina Chocolate Drops Grammy-winning album called Genuine Negro Jig, and the song is called Hit 'Em Up Style. So it sounds like everybody, if you record someone or you want to work with somebody, they come to your house, yes?
Not always. I mean, it's not for everybody. I mean, that situation is very particular, and it's great for a lot of things. But it's also fun to, you know, to go out. I mean, I just made a record that's just come out with musician and actor Hugh Laurie. And, yes. You know, we went to the, you know, to a big studio in town because we could, and it was fun. You know, when the budget allows it, I don't mind pulling up and seeing a parking space with my name on it. I don't mind a runner asking me if I want another espresso, you know. I live with that just fine. And that was a fantastic project. I also just produced a record I'm really proud of that comes out next week for a young Irish singer-songwriter named Lisa Hannigan, who's mm-hmm. just fantastic. And we went to a really old residential studio in North Wales. You know, she and her band wanted to get out of Dublin because it's, you know, it's a really small community, and they just wanted to get out of town and kind of go into the submarine. And so my engineer Ryan and I met them in Wales in Snowdonia.
Oh, how nice.
It was fantastic.
But do you like the idea of sort of living on top of the store in a way? I mean, having your recording studio in what was the kitchen in the house that you live in?
Well, I say that all the time, actually, that I say, you know, I bought a store and we live upstairs from it. I do like it a lot, though, you know, at a point, I know it is. It asks a lot of my family. It's an intensely personal thing mm-hmm. to have, you know, a session, you know, in the house. Even though, you know, more often than not, the nucleus of the band are people that my family, you know, absolutely love. I mean, they are family members to us at this point. But it asks a lot. And, you know, I could imagine a day in my future when my wife may say, you know, really?
Another one?
Yeah. But she's incredibly supportive about the whole enterprise.
Well, that's great. Well, I do want to play another album you produced, the Over the Rhine album, The Long Surrender. And this is a song called Infamous Love Song. Let's listen to this.
It's a good one.
It is.
I say the bebop apocalypse. Lean into you, God's hands on my hips. Grip the midnight microphone. Steal every cell of my flesh and bone. I wrestle my angel in smoky stage lights. Climb Jacob's ladder to 1,000 more flights. Tell St. Valentine, hey, give me 5. Baby, our love song must survive. We were born in the dirt on our hands and knees, but started out climbing deciduous trees. We learned to swear ridiculously high, hungry to taste mouthfuls of sky. Now I bring all our secrets to show and tell, how we dragged each other through heaven and hell. It's our smoking gun, but hey, we're still alive. Survive. Your third story windows on 13th and May.
A song called Infamous Love Song from Over the Rhine's album The Long Surrender. And I have to say, Joe Henry was telling me while we were listening, one take. That was one take.
That was a single take, and there was a lot of that on that record. That was a really remarkable, unusual project. Karen is a remarkably great singer, and her husband Linford, who wrote that song, that's as good as anything Leonard Cohen wrote. I mean, if you hear the whole thing, it's in league. It's that deep as a piece of writing, and everybody in the room knew it. I remember Lucinda Williams came by the studio that night because she was singing on a song with us, with Karen, and you know we had just done that, and we played that. I said, oh, play Infamous Love Song for Lou. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she just fell over.
That's a great song.
It is a great song.
So did you think this is, when you were 14, and you were talking to your school counselor, did you think this is where you were going to end up?
Oh, no. You know, at that age, I'm sure I didn't know what a record producer did. And I still don't identify myself as a record producer. I mean, I'm getting better at saying that without blushing. Mm-hmm. I'm a songwriter first. I mean, as a producer, I still approach everything from the point of view of a songwriter and recording artist. That's still the lens that I look through. Song is trump. And if there's ever a problem in the studio with getting a song, I invariably say, you know, in some way, sometimes more diplomatically than others, you know, it's not about you, it's about it. Mm-hmm. You know, stop thinking about how this represents you as an artist, and just think about how you are putting a light on this song. And you know, as soon as you get into that mind, problems disappear.
So are you your own producer?
Yes. I have been for a long time. Right. I mean, I have worked with other people, and I'm not adverse. I mean, I tried really hard when I made my record called Fuse in 1997, I think it was. I tried really hard to get Dr. Dre to produce it. I thought that would have been exactly the right thing. And I would have worked with Dre, and I would still work with Dre. I couldn't interest him. He's one of the very few people who's ever said no to me, you know.
Oh, really?
I've gotten a lot of people to say yes to me that, you know, that probably, you know, shouldn't have or wouldn't have, except that I was taught to write a good letter when I was young. But I couldn't get Dre to take me seriously for some reason.
Oh, interesting. So you're comfortable producing your own stuff?
Well, you know, I'm so particular, I guess, when I describe writing before as discovery. Recording is that too. So, I like the hunt. I like the discovery. And, you know, if I thought there was something that merited bringing somebody else into that chair, you know, I have no ego about it.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you so much, Joe Henry, for joining us today in Radio Times. It's been a great pleasure.
Marty, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Joe Henry, our guest. And the show was produced by Dennis Devine, and our engineers have been Al Banks and Kevin Griffin. We do want to close things out with another song from Joe Henry's forthcoming album. It's due out in October, and the album is called Reverie, and the song is called Tomorrow is October. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.
The scrubby hills they flash their teeth, all iron will and disbelief. I move to rise, but just as soon. Now here's that first dark afternoon. Cold and golden cross and scolding, even angels who lord over when tomorrow is October. When tomorrow is October. When tomorrow is October. When tomorrow is October. Thank you.